9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here on your Jazz and Justice Pacifica Foundation radio station out of Washington, D.C., WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. If you're new to this hour, We the People is a news magazine. We are dedicated to the long form of a deep dive into issues and concerns that face us all. The topics are usually from the realms of history, politics, race, and culture. And it means that just about anything goes because we live in many different modalities every day. Part of the station's mandate is to build a better community, one broadcast at a time. I seek to do that with about 80 to 100 other programmers offering you, again, jazz and justice. So welcome and thank you. Today's topic is a look at violence against women and girls, particularly domestic violence and femicide. Recently, the United Nations released a report indicating that one woman or girl is killed every 10 minutes by their intimate partner or family member. The National Network to End Domestic Violence reports that one in three women, one in four men, and nearly half of LGBTQ plus people will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Domestic violence and femicide remain persistent global problems throughout communities everywhere. Yet much can be done to change this, and we'll examine these issues in this hour. We'll do that with our guest, Kalopi Mingeru. Ms. Mingeru is the chief of the Ending Violence Against Women and Girls section at the UN Women in New York. And prior to joining UN Women, she worked as a lawyer in Greece, and at an international level, she worked with UN agencies as well as international non-governmental organizations in the areas of human rights, women's human rights, and refugee protections in several countries. Karma Kottman serves as chief executive officer with UGIMA, the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. And before joining UGIMA, Ms. Kottman, a Washington, D.C. native, led the D.C. Coalition Against Domestic Violence as executive director for a decade. Prior to that, she served with the National Network to End Domestic Violence, often referred to as NNEDV, for a decade as well. And as Vice President of Policy and Emerging Issues there, she directed the agency's policy agenda, supervised NNEDV's state coalition and housing technical assistance projects. She currently serves on the steering committee of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community and the Policy Partnership for Communities of Color. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being with us this morning. Given the division of time and the fact that you're both very busy with a lot of projects and activities, we're going to divide the show roughly in half, but I want to acknowledge to the audience that you both are present with us as we talk about this issue. And I have to advise people that this is a very mature subject. It may not be suitable for all audiences, but our concerns are important to everyone on this planet. Ms. Minjeru, thank you for being with us. This is a busy time. And, you know, I understand that a lot's been happening in the last month or two. On November 25th, the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, UN Women released the report Femicides in 2023, Global Estimates of Intimate Partner and Family Member Femicides. This is the most extreme violence against women and girls. Globally, sadly to say, 85,000 women and girls are killed intentionally, at least in 2023. 60% of these homicides, that's a little over 51,000, were committed by intimate partners or family members. So that means that the data would show that 140 women and girls die every day at the hands of their partner or close relative. That means one woman is killed every 10 minutes. Can you help us further on a couple of things? First of all, for those that are unfamiliar, UN Women is an organization within the United Nations. What's its mission? What is its activities?
First of all, thank you so much for hosting UN Women in your show. It's very, very important for us to raise awareness about the issues that we're working on, about gender equality, about ending violence against women and girls, especially as we had the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, which finished yesterday. So very important moments for humanity. Just to remind your audience, our audience, that UN Women, as you said, it's a United Nations organization. We have a dedicated mandate, a dedicated mission to address gender-based discrimination, to bring more gender equality around the world by helping governments and our partners in order to have the capacities, the knowledge, to have the right laws and policies in place to address gender inequality. And we have a lot of thematic areas that we're working on. We're working on increasing women's political participation, for example, strengthening women's economic empowerment, and also bringing women's organizations' voices to women, peace, and security agendas around the world. Ending violence against women and girls is a key area for UN Women since our creation, because we strongly believe that we cannot achieve gender equality anywhere if half the population of the world is facing abuse, violence, and of course, discrimination in their everyday lives. From the moment they leave their homes to take the train, to take the bus, public transportation, to walk in public spaces, then at school, at the offices, and then going back home where they may face intimate partner violence, violence from the people that they love and they trust.
So granted all those ways of everyday life that you described, we're dealing with a continuum of, I hate to put it this way, malevolence throughout society. There are values and standards and practices. So even things that exacerbate refugee status or wars or climate change or economic injustice. Those things precipitate this unfortunate reality of women being attacked or victimized or abused. And I thought I read somewhere that that about 736 million women across the globe will face violence in some form of another well within their lifetime. So here's the thing. This report was quite dramatic, quite important, will remain so. And how long has, is this is not the first report, obviously. How long has this effort been going on? And then what are we to make of this number of 51,000 women and girls are killed by intimate partners?
Indeed, these rates are alarming. Think about it. 85,000 women, they were killed, and girls were killed intentionally last year. This is a global crisis. And as you said, more than 51,000, more than 60% of these women, they were killed at home by someone they trusted, by someone they loved. And we have these global figures that you mentioned. One in three women globally, they have been facing some form of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, as we call it sometimes, or non-partner violence, at least once in their lifetimes. And we have, this violence starts early, especially the domestic intimate partner violence. We have one in four adolescent girls that they have faced intimate partner violence at least once before they reach the age of 19 years old. So that says a lot about the fact that this violence starts early. This violence is perpetrated by younger men, younger boys early. And it says a lot about the values, the norms, the beliefs that really make such violence so normalized in our everyday lives. And I have to say that this is just, unfortunately, the tip of the iceberg. And I'm saying that because these are just the numbers that we got from national statistical offices, from official authorities. And of course, we work very closely with our partners to see if we can get more information. But the majority of survivors, especially survivors of domestic violence, intimate partner violence, we know that they do not seek help from official authorities. Like 40% of women who have experienced this violence, we know that they do not go to any kind of official authorities. And then 10% of these women do not seek support from the police. And you can imagine why. There is huge stigma for survivors of violence in the local communities, by their families as well. And in so many places as well, domestic violence is really treated as a private affair that needs to be handled between the partners, between the spouses or the partners within the family, that it doesn't concern the public arena, it doesn't concern the police forces. So survivors, they have really lost the confidence on the police or authorities that they can really get there to help them. And you know what we hear from many survivors is that what they really want sometimes is for the violence to stop. And I think this is a very serious issue. So we need to have more efficient responses by the police and by the authorities to these calls of domestic violence, to make sure that they do intervene on time, because in many of the cases of femicide, for example, we had history recorded beforehand that the victims, they hadn't been calling the police, that they had been asking for help, and the police did not react on time, or they didn't issue, the court didn't issue protection orders.
Or perhaps in many situations, the law enforcement was the non-intimate perpetrator of violence against these women. So how do you go to another source of a potential abuser?
Of course, this is a good addition. So as I said before, the figures we have is just the tip of the iceberg. There's so many women who do not report to the authorities, to the police, or we don't have official data. And because you mentioned the global data of more than 700 million of women have suffered some form of violence, I have to say that there it's even more dark as a figure, because this data does not capture sexual harassment data. We
That's
don't
an important
have
distinction. Yes.
Exactly. We don't have information about sexual harassment that women and girls face every day in public spaces, from some forms that they may seem to be innocent, but they are, together with other forms that they are facing of violence and abuse, it can become very threatening for women and girls every day, and also can really make them feel not safe to go around, to have access to public spaces, which is really a very big gap for public life. And also, it becomes sometimes an impediment even for women to exercise their political rights, the rights to be there and to be a part of public life, to be a part of public office, and to be members of the society, active members, full members of the society. So I'm afraid the data is even darker out there.
Whether it's femicide, domestic violence, or harassment, women are to be saluted for the tremendous pushback and counter forces for justice and human dignity. If you think about all the flashpoints, I'll just quickly do this because I want to respect your time. But in South Korea, there's a whole thing about technology and social media and just common folkways and expressions that are part of the ramp or the gate to more severe oppression and abuse of women. In France, the woman who was married for a long time and was drugged continuously and suffered mass rapes. Of course, Afghanistan, we talk about this all the time, the fallouts of how there's a commingling of war and domestic violence on the continent of Africa. In England, women have been abused by law enforcement repeatedly, and their outcry has caught public attention and public responsibility. In the Southern Hemisphere, on this side of the planet, especially I think of Mexico, women have not had supreme achievements, but they've made tremendous, tremendous progress in getting the justice they need to exist as human beings and so on. So that leads me to say, are there important takeaways? I cringe at saying this, of regional differences in this report. Is there anything you want us to keep in mind in terms of how they're snapshots of different major portions of the world?
What I really want us to keep in mind as a key message is that violence against women and girls is a universal phenomenon. It happens in every part of the world. No territory of this world is exempted from this phenomenon. I think this is really key. We may have some variations of data, And also that varies according to the population and the sizes of the population. But let's remember that it is universal and it's happening everywhere. And it happens to women and girls regardless their status in society, their race, their ethnicity, their religion. It happens everywhere.
And again, I want to salute the work of UN Women, because even though you said there's a variance in reportage from different sources, numbers in themselves are not impressive, but 160 countries are now part of the data, and the fact that you give that data and research a lot of meaning in the various topics you've already mentioned. You mentioned at the outset of our conversation that there's 16 days of activism. And of course, we want that activism to continue beyond the 16 days. But the fact that we were getting to have the facts around this important concern means it's preventable, that things can be done, not only on a governmental level, but on a society level as well. If you could just end off with a sense of what we can do or what's being done, I would appreciate it.
It's very, very important, first at governmental level, and that's what UN Women's work is about, to make sure that we have the right laws and policies in place, not only to address violence against women and girls, but also to address broader discrimination against women around divorce processes, custody of children, having access to resources, etc. But it is very important at the same time to have services in place in order to make sure that they address the needs of survivors in the aftermath of the violence they experienced. But having done all these things are important, but we cannot really get into the heart of the problem if we do not address prevention. And prevention of violence against women and girls, to make sure that we are getting into the heart of the issue and addressing the beliefs and the attitudes and behaviors that really, really justify such violence against women and girls. So education can start early to educate young girls, young boys about the role of and the stereotypes around men and women and girls and boys. And I think we all have a role to play, supporting our local organizations, supporting women's shelters, and providing and extending our support is very important during 16 days of activism and beyond, of course.
Well, thank you. Again, we've been speaking to Calliope Mingiru. Ms. Mingiru is the chief of Ending Violence Against Women and Girls section at the UN Women Agency in New York. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Listeners, again, you're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We're here talking about a look at violence against women and girls. We've taken a look at domestic violence and femicide. We will continue to look at those issues with our second guest, Karma Kottman. Ms. Kottman is the Chief Executive Officer with UGIMA, the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. She has worked for the DC Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She has served in executive roles at the National Network to End Domestic Violence. And Ms. Kottman, am I getting it right? You currently serve on the steering committee of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community and the Policy Partnership for Communities of Color. Have I gotten all that correct?
You have. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me join this morning.
Thank you. I know you were listening attentively to our previous guest.
Yes.
We're coming up to the halfway point of our show. It's the end of the year, and I have a number of house duties to do, so I'm going to do them a little bit early. Listeners, I want to personally thank you throughout the year, quarter after quarter, for supporting WPFW, supporting this program, but the many other programs that offer you jazz and justice. It's with your help that we're able to survive. We've done more than survive. We've been thriving for over 47 years, going into a 48th year. If you listen carefully to announcements or if you go to our website, you'll find many, many different ways to donate and financially support us. And importantly, possibly become a sustaining member. A little goes a long, long way when we put ourselves together and put our minds, our hearts, and our wherewithal to many of the different functions. I cannot say enough of a thank you to you. In the next few weeks, as we close out the year, you will not hear We the People as is normally broadcast, but there'll be a number of specials dedicated to Amiri Baraka, Quincy Jones, celebrating the best of our various holidays and traditions and ethical commitments as we strive to help each other. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here with you. It makes a difference. It's made a difference in my life, but the communities, friends, and neighbors that I know. So once again, thank you. Coming up is a number of programs that give you a good reason why I've said constantly Wednesday after Wednesday to listen to WPFW. I'll start out with at 3 to 5 o'clock on this terrestrial broadcast, Sophie's Parlor, the oldest women's collective that I know in public broadcasting, bringing you music and culture by women but for everyone. At 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin and Shay Wanana covers Middle Eastern concerns and affairs. Certainly that's terribly important to not only the people in the region, but all of us. At 1 o'clock, my friend and colleague, Moise Mutali, with producer James Pope, brings you Africa Now. It's a look at the history, politics, culture, and various concerns and issues of African descended people, not only in the continent, but throughout the diaspora. And you can't go wrong with that kind of lineup, folks, whether it's Wednesday or some other day of the week right here at WPFW. Once again, thank you for your support. Now, as a service to you, we're going to take an early break and we will join Ms. Cotman after we hear these public service announcements. And thank you for listening. Stick with us.
During our upcoming end of year pledge drive from December 15th through the 21st, WPFW offers you the gift of knowledge as we dedicate the week to Brothers of Culture and Resistance, Bill Lucy, Quincy Jones, and Amiri Baraka. On Monday, December 16th, we commemorate Bill Lucy and the Black Workers Movement. Wednesday, December 18th, it's From the Pen of Q, a Quincy Jones retrospective. We close with Baraka at 90 on Thursday, December 19th. Detailed schedule at WPFWFM.org. You can give the gift of knowledge anytime by texting WPFWFM to 801-801. Helping us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. Today's topic is a look at violence against women and girls. We've heard from Kalopi Mingiru, who is the chief of Ending Violence Against Women and Girls section at the UN Women Agency in New York. We're now joining Karma Cotman. Ms. Cotman, again, is the CEO of UJIMA, the Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. And Ms. Cotman, again, thank you for being with us. I want to be quite deliberate in my welcome to you. Allow me to remind people that this is a mature subject. It's not for all audiences, but it's definitely something that affects all of us as we talk about it. I'm also going to do a little shopkeeping here and say points of contact for you. The UN Women can be found simply at unwomen1word.org. You might want to use an upward slash and use the letters EN for English, and you'll get a page that's full of resources. But similarly, UJIMA offers a number of resources, and you can find that information at ujimacommunity1word.org. And UJIMA is spelled UJIMA. Just add community to it, then yes. Add .org, and that will get you to the website, and you can make contact. Important phone numbers for people, and I should have done this at the top of the show. We'll start with Ujima. 1-844-77-UJIMA. 1-844-77-UJIMA. And then the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233. National Domestic Violence Hotline, again, is 1-800-799-7233. And the National Sexual Assault Hotline is 800-656-HOPE. Hopefully I'll get to repeat all that information again before we leave. So without further ado, Ms. Cotman, again, welcome and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Can you tell us about UJIMA, its mission? I think you started around 2015. So its mission and activities, if you please. And I'm going to highlight some of your expertise also, which is very important, I think, to particularly to our local listeners as well.
Absolutely. So UJIMA is a national organization. We are a culturally specific organization. So for that, that means one that's developed by and for the Black community. We provide technical assistance and training. We do research, community outreach and community engagement and policy advocacy around the issues of domestic violence, sexual assault, and community violence in the Black community. And I often have to explain what we are, and then people say, what does all that mean? What does technical assistance and training and all those things mean? And so, you know, what that really means is that we work to ensure that Black women and girls and the totality of our community have access to the resources that they need when they experience violence. And that when they do reach out, the systems that they engage with are responsive, that they can trust in those systems, that they have access to housing, counseling, advocacy for their children, et cetera, and that all of those services are informed by our community, and that also we are supporting the development and capacity of organizations that are not just informed by, but they're steeped in our realities, they are engaged in and understand our realities, and like our UJIMA are reflective of our community from the board to those individuals that are providing services.
Fantastic. So in every way possible, you're trying to create capacity and response within our communities. Thank you. I guess we should really get right into something. I don't like talking about stuff in the abstract, and I don't think you do either. When a woman experiences violence or abuse, what are the signs or the red flags? What are the signals that we should really have in mind and then do something about?
Mr. Westone, it's one of those things that for so many of us, people say, what are the signs and how do we, and they really show up in so many ways. So the first one is isolation. Like if you're with someone and they always want to be with you and feel like they're taking you away from family and friends. And one of the things that for many of us is actually a red flag, but we don't see it, is someone who seems like they are overly affectionate. And so the first week, 2 weeks, they're saying, I love you. They're always wanting to be around you. It's almost obsessive behavior. They're controlling. They're using language that feels like they're putting you down. But also recognizing that this is also about power and control. So someone who wants to exert power over you, over your decisions. So simple things like, are you going to wear that today? Is that appropriate? And making it seem like it comes from a place of caring, but in fact, it comes from a place of control. And, you know, your previous guest talked about experiences, particularly recognizing that so many women experience domestic violence and sexual assault, and that it happens at, young ages all the way through adulthood, right? And so I often talk about, especially for the Black community, understanding that those young women between the ages of 16 to 24 are experiencing violence at astronomically high rates. And those very warning signs around having someone isolate or having someone be jealous or having someone be controlling or having someone be overly exerted, for young girls, those tend to be the things that could be attractive, right? And so it's also important for family and friends to be aware of what those warning signs are so that they can, when you see them, you can help to point them out in a loving, not in a judgmental, but in a loving way.
You know, I really appreciate the points you just shared. As a parent myself and as a relative to other young women, and then involved in communities of faith and community organizations, I would even say that I'm not alone in saying, not only is it language or behavior at you, but watch how this other person is talking about women in general. Do they respect young girls? Do they respect elders? And really put some substance behind that. You know, no role playing, but trust your instincts.
Yes.
Trust what's going on inside of you, and those who you respect and love you are telling you, please, please do that.
Yes.
So we've opened up a lot, but I want to kind of make a rational progression in our conversation. Yes. And you've been very modest about the programs. The one thing I didn't add to your bio, which a lot of listeners pick up on and inform how your expertise and experience will inform us, but you've also worked in rural Florida as well. Yes. So you've worked in urban and rural settings. You've worked in many different types of Black communities.
Yes.
And I want to get that across. And since I've mentioned that, are there any real differences or anything you want to highlight from that experience?
You know, the sense of isolation is very different in rural communities. I, you know, experienced in working in rural Florida this recognition that where here in the DC area, you might be able to easily get to a shelter or easily get to a program. It's not the same across the country and in rural communities, where you might have access to resources like easily someone, law enforcement responding if you call 911 or others. It takes time in rural communities. In addition, everyone knows everyone's business, right? It's not the same. You're not keeping something to yourself. So that sense of, can you really share when something's happening in your household? That sense of a loss of being able to do that in a rural community. And also, you know, really experiencing what it means to, you know, be one of one in some communities, right? That where you don't see as many other Black people in your community. And so that you're already isolated or already feeling a sense of a loss of community. And then you touched on this issue, Mr. Whetstone, of what faith means. And so I really see in rural communities a reliance on faith leaders and faith community as a way and a means of support, a means of intervention, a means of guidance. And not that that doesn't happen in here locally as well. So it definitely happens here locally as well, particularly in the Black community. But there's just something additional that happens in rural communities as well.
And thank you, Ms. Hotman, but and David is just fine, by the way.
And Karma is fine as well.
Okay, thank you, Karma. Since you mentioned faith communities, I want to maybe cover three important stakeholders. You have a program activity that's directed to HBCUs that engage students, faculty, and administrators. The third group that we should add in the mix are sororities and fraternities. What have you seen? What have they been doing? And quite frankly, what can we do better? And you can pick any group of the stakeholders you like to explain that for us, please.
So we do. We have a program that works specifically with HBCUs, and we've got to get better in all these places, quite frankly, David. We need our sororities and fraternities to talk more about domestic violence and sexual assault, not just from a perspective of the warning signs and safety, because they need to be doing that, but also prevention. And you talked about this earlier, what it means that these things are preventable. And so, how do we talk about women and girls in general? Are we respecting women and girls?
What kind of culture are we
What
nurturing
kind
to
of
develop?
culture are we? Exactly. And that's the work that has to happen on HBCU campuses. It's a culture change and a culture shift. And that's really at the root of the work at Ujima. It's really shifting the culture around women and girls, how we value and are respected. And then for Black women and girls in particular, how we are valued and respected in terms of our safety.
I'm glad you mentioned this last point because there were things in the news that, besides conversations with people, that provoked my attention to dedicate a show to this. The big one is Black women are 6 times more likely to be killed than white women. A decade worth of data study from 30 states from the Centers of the Disease Control and Prevention indicated again. Black women are 6 times more likely to be killed by than white women by I guess both intimate partners and non-intimate partners. I think that's the survey. And this was reported in the medical community's journal, The Lancet. They focused in this news story from NBC focused in on the Midwest for a moment, and in Wisconsin, for example. Black women are 20 times more likely to be killed than white women. And they're more likely to be killed by a firearm, which is a problem not only in the Midwest, but in other states as well. So I know you've got an initiative that deals with firearm policy. What more do you want to say about this alarming observation?
David, it is alarming, and the piece is that what you heard is that this is over 30 years. So we haven't made significant advances in this issue of Black women's safety, and particularly as it relates to firearms. And so what we've been doing through our program, one is raising awareness, two is really working closely with jurisdictions so that law enforcement and others can take seriously when they hear and or women report being impacted by domestic violence, and asking questions about, is there a firearm in the home? Having an understanding that that elevates the realities around lethality for Black women in particular. And so really looking at this, and then at its core, how we value our lives. And one of the things that I really want to focus on is that there is this sense that Black women and girls almost inherit this idea of being unsafe, that that's just something that we have to bear. And so we put on this piece about being a strong Black woman and having to bear all of these things. But the reality is that we deserve to be safe. Black women and girls deserve to be safe. And so this piece around when you are experiencing violence, you don't have to remain silent. There is not this kind of loyalty that we've built up in our community where you can't snitch, you can't tell, you can't do all these things. But at the end of the day, we are talking about women who are losing their lives at the hands of the people that they love and the people that they care about most. And so our initiative really is about raising awareness, and it's about working in jurisdictions like Wisconsin with law enforcement, making sure that they are also partnering with culturally specific communities. So law enforcement has got to partner with the Black community to understand what we're experiencing so that our efforts and initiatives can resonate with our community.
Just to support your point, one survey said approximately 45% of Black women experienced stalking, physical and sexual violence in their lifetimes, and that an estimated 51% of Black female adult homicides were and indeed are related to intimate partner violence. There's another aspect to this that supports just what you're saying. And it's sad, again, there are enough examples. One case would be enough that's alarming. But the Black girls experiencing trafficking,
yes,
or calling out for help, notwithstanding trafficking, to law enforcement. Here in our broadcast area, there have been, sadly, over the last decade or so, in the news, the fact that sometimes people who have the responsibility of law enforcement have been abusers as well. And then if that wasn't enough, sadly, if you're caught up in trafficking or illegal sex work, the sexual abuse to prison pipeline, where young Black girls and women defend themselves and they get the full false punishment of the law. All these things are very difficult, but they should wake us up and they should move us to action. And you're saying on a number of fronts, we can make a difference.
Yes, we can make a difference. And those stats, the statistics that you just raised, are things that, one, people don't know, right? People are not aware of the alarming rates of sexual assault, domestic violence, intimate partner violence in our communities. They're not aware that 40%+ of trafficking victims are actually Black women. They're not aware of stalking in our community. And at the root of it, you know, people will look at these numbers, and often we're having conversations where we're having to talk about, it's not that the Black community is just more violent. So it's not that we're just inherently more violent.
And can I stop you just for a moment also? Most of these crimes are within groups. They're intra-racial. So it's not that other people groups don't have the same problems, often with the same proportionality. Or if it's less, there are other mitigating circumstances. I'm sorry, I'm compressing the point, but I wanted to get that out.
No, it's so important, David, because what we have to look at is, again, the culture shift that has to happen in our community as it relates to how we value Black women and girls and how we value life in general. And so, you know, one of the things that we also work on is the issue of community violence, because what we've seen is that for our community, because of our experiences with race, oppression, and violence in our communities, then you layer on things like access to guns, economic opportunity, as you talked about.
When the pandemic happened, the shutdown that people experienced.
Exactly. Housing instability, all of those things make us more vulnerable to experiencing violence. And then layered on with what you just talked about, distrust of systems, and that distrust comes from experience with systems, right? It's not that it comes from nowhere, but it's because of our experiences with systems that we don't trust them. And because when they do respond, we're afraid of what that response will be. Our children are you know, more likely to be taken away in the child welfare system. Of course, we've seen harm from law enforcement. We go into the judicial system and we don't have the same responses. And so all of those things make us distrustful of systems. And so the convergence of that is these higher rates of violence and higher rates of femicide for us, for Black women. And so our advocacy as Ujima is about, one, of course, lifting up these numbers so that our community understands what happens and is happening in our community, but also recognizing, and our name, Ujima, is really because we've got to be the answer to the problem.
Collective work and responsibility.
Yes. We can end it, but it's going to take all of us coming together to end the issues of gender-based violence and to shift our culture.
Again, we're talking to Kama Cotman. She's the chief executive officer with Ujima, the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. This would be a good time so you can had the last word. Let me give you important numbers and information again. Earlier in the show, we had a representative of UN Women, Kalapi Mangiru, who's the chief of Ending Violence Against Women and Girls section at UN Women. Their website is simply unwomen1word.org. The National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-800-799-7233. The National Sexual Assault Hotline is 800-656-HOPE. And Ms. Cotman's organization, Ujima Community, can be found at ujimacommunity1word.org, or use the phone number 1-844-77-UJIMA, UJIMA. Ms. Cotman, again, thank you for being with us. You summed it up rather nicely, but you do have 2 minutes to go further. Like our previous guests, you're emphasizing these acts of violence against women are preventable. They are preventable. Again, remind us what we can do.
So, you know, David, it's timely that we're having this conversation, because one of the things I would say as sort of closing out is check on your family and friends. The holidays are a particularly difficult time when we think about domestic violence and sexual assault. And so making sure that we as a community are aware of what the signs are around domestic violence and sexual assault, then when someone comes to us, that we engage with them from a loving and knowledgeable place rather than a place of judgment. One of the things we often hear is, why did you stay? Why would you be there? Why? I would never. Not helpful. They're the things that keep people in the closet, make them feel like they can't tell. So making sure that we are there for people when they do share, recognizing that people, it generally takes 5 to 7 times for a survivor to leave a violent situation. So the first time they disclose is not going to be the last time they disclose. And so that can be frustrating even for advocates, but you got to stay the course. Those are the things that I would just leave your listeners, because again, as you said, this is preventable. And for Ujima, it is about collective responsibility. So there is the culture shift. But right now, what I would say is be loving, be caring, listen to the people in your lives, and get educated so that you can share resources with them if they are experiencing violence.
Thank you. Again, we were talking to Karma Cotman. Ms. Cotman is the Chief Executive Officer with Ujima, the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. Our earlier guest was Kalapi Mangiru. Ms. Mangiru is the Chief of the Ending Violence Against Women and Girls section at UN Women. Our topic has been a look at violence against women and girls, domestic violence, and femicide. Hopefully, we can take further steps to reduce and eventually eliminate that problem. I thank both of my guests for their efforts and contributions toward that end. I thank you, the listener, for always being willing to listen to WPFW. I also ask at this time, where we are summoning generosity one from another to strengthen one another, that you consider WPFW in mind when you support your Jazz and Justice station. You've joined others who have supported it for more than 47 years. We're trying to build better communities one broadcast at a time. People who help us do that are like my engineer, Mike Nasella. My thanks to him. Even the noontime hour, where we don't forget the blues, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Bluesman Turner, will have a relevancy to how we think and do things in this world. Jazz and Justice, all because of you, and I thank you. This will be my last time with you in 2024. As we close out the year, I wish you peace, stability, and love, and that we get to celebrate one another, the best of our traditions and commitments in our communities. Thank you. Thank you for being with us. And hopefully again, we'll meet on the radio. Take good care.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Scott Baba. Israel carried out a wave of heavy airstrikes across Syria as its troops advanced deeper into the country. This according to a Syrian opposition war monitor yesterday. The Israeli defense minister announced that his forces had destroyed Syria's navy, and Israel acknowledged pushing into a buffer zone inside Syria following the overthrow of President Bashar Assad. But it remained unclear if Israeli soldiers had gone beyond that area, which was established more than 50 years ago. Israel denied that it was advancing on the Syrian capital of Damascus. Charles de Ledesma reports.
Israel said on Tuesday it had bombed more than 350 military sites in Syria during the previous 48-hour period. Targeting weapons stockpiles in the country, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the wave of strikes are necessary to keep the weapons from being used against Israel following the Syrian government's stunning collapse. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, the insurgents who overthrew the Syrian government now say they've wrested control of the eastern city of Deir el-Zour after intense battles with a Kurdish-led US-backed force. People in cars and on the streets wave arms and appear to celebrate. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Prime Minister of Syria's new transitional government, Mohammed al-Bashir, has called for calm and stability, vowing to guarantee the rights of all communities in the country. He appealed to the millions of Syrians living abroad to return and help rebuild the country. The European Union's foreign affairs chief, Kaja Kallas, has urged against acts of revenge and retaliation in Syria. She said early signs following the ouster of Assad were promising, but added that it's too early to issue a verdict. William Denislow reports.
Speaking to members of the European Parliament, Kaja Kallas said that the rebel group that led the offensive against Assad should be judged on their deeds, not words. She added that the first signals from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, were good, but that the EU won't rush to any arrangements. Because of its terrorist designation, the EU is not in direct contact with the group. Kallas has called for minorities to be protected in Syria, adding that the weaponization of religion must be averted. William Denslow, Brussels.
Palestinian medical officials say Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 29 people. One of the strikes hit a home where displaced people were sheltering in the isolated north, killing 19. A separate strike outside the hospital killed a woman and her two children, and another strike in central Gaza killed at least 7 people. There were no immediate comments from the Israeli military. The man charged with murder in the killing of the CEO of United Healthcare made it clear he wasn't going to make things easy for authorities, shouting at reporters as he was led into court and then objecting to being taken to New York to face trial.
And it's completely out of touch, and it's an insult to the intelligence of the American people and lived experience.
The displays of resistance yesterday weren't expected to significantly delay legal proceedings for Luigi Nicholas Mangione, who was charged in last week's Manhattan killing of Brian Thompson, the leader of the United States' largest medical insurance company. He wrote that the U.S. has the most expensive healthcare system in the world and that profits of major corporations continue to rise, while, quote, our life expectancy does not. Democratic lawmakers are calling on outgoing President Joe Biden to use his executive powers to address critical progressive issues before the end of his term and the beginning of the next Trump administration. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
Democrats want outgoing President Joe Biden to commute the sentences of the 40 federal prisoners on death row to life without parole. Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says state-sanctioned murder is not justice.
The death penalty is a cruel, racist, and fundamentally flawed punishment that has no place in our society.
Presley says in his campaign, Biden promised to address the federal death penalty. Project 2025, the blueprint for a second Trump term, calls for an increase in federal executions. Another progressive, outgoing Missouri Representative Cori Bush wants Biden to certify the Equal Rights Representative Cori Bush wants Biden to certify the Equal Rights Amendment before his term ends. Bush says enough states approve.